Hey everybody, this is Joseph. I'm guessing you're listening because you do care a lot about connecting with your non-Christian friends. Do you want your words to be valued and remembered after you've had a conversation with a non-Christian friend? If so, as you're sharing scripture, also use analogies, use quotes, use stories. And if you want to learn a whole bunch of good ones to use, go read a new book titled The God Conversation by J.P. Moreland and Tim Muehlhoff. We tracked down Tim Muehlhoff recently outside a coffee shop in Southern California to find out what the big deal is about stories. So, Tim, the God Conversation, like, what's the need out there? What are you trying to address? Why did you write this book?
Well, what we tried to do, my co-author is J.P. Moreland, Christian philosopher, and we thought, let's bring together an apologist, somebody like J.P. Moreland, who's just well-respected for his philosophy and his apologetics, but let's bring him together with a communication professor, and that's myself. I teach communication at Biola University. And the whole book is based on a communication principle, and that principle is, as soon as a conversation ends, a person walks away from a conversation and literally forgets half of it immediately. And then 8 hours later, they are down to 20% that they remember. And communication theorists have been very interested in that 20%. What is it that people tend to remember long after the conversation is over? And the answer is illustrations, quotes, stories stay with a person. So if we want to make our conversations about God and faith memorable, so when the conversation is finished, that person will walk away and 10 hours later, 2 days later, a week later, they will be remembering what we said, but specifically, they'll remember the illustrations and the stories that we slipped into the conversation as we talked about Christ and faith.
In some of the promotional materials that I've seen in a magazine, the little advertisement regarding your book, The God Conversation, said, picture this apologetics. It kind of tried to describe the book or summarize the book as picture this apologetics. What are you shooting for? What do you mean by that?
Well, an illustration is not an argument. We have to be clear about that. So we first give a response to a question, but then we add an illustration, knowing that that illustration is what's going to be remembered. So if somebody were to say to us in a post 9/11 culture, why in the world does God allow evil to happen? Well, one of the answers is the famous C.S. Lewis quote, which is that pain and suffering is God's megaphone. It's how he gets our attention. Now, that's an answer. What we then would suggest is slip in an illustration from popular culture. So after answering why does God allow a 9/11 to happen, a tsunami to happen, I would give that answer that God gets our attention through it. And then I would use an illustration maybe from American Idol. In the sixth season of American Idol, the producers decided to have this campaign called Idol Gives Back. And they were going to raise funds to address poverty in Africa and the inner city in the United States. Well, Simon Cowell went off to Africa, and film crews went with him, and he walks into this village that has been ravaged by AIDS. And he walks into a hut where a woman has 14 children. 8 of those children are AIDS orphans that she's taken in. And he is visibly shaken as you watch this clip. And he keeps saying, this isn't right. This isn't right. And that's exactly what God is saying. I will allow poverty, AIDS, suffering to exist. I'll allow it. Because it gets our attention. And if Simon Cowell, my goodness, a man who just cares about finding the next pop icon, if suffering can get Simon Cowell to stop just for a second and say, there's something not right about our world, that's a really valuable place to be in a conversation because we feel like we have the answer to why the world is not what it should be.
In the book, you refer to 1 Peter 3:15, be ready to give an explanation for the hope that is in us. But then you say, a lot needs to be explained, and you lay out some objections there. Tell me, what is it that needs to be explained?
Well, in the first part of the book, we mention a concept philosophers talk about. It's called a defeater belief. And all what a defeater belief is you have a certain belief that makes other beliefs impossible to have. Let me give you a for instance. I have 3 boys. They are basketball nuts. They are absolutely convinced that Dwayne Wade is the best basketball player who has ever played the game. Okay? So I'm from Detroit, okay? I hate Chicago Bulls. But even I will say to my three kids, guys, what about Michael Jordan? You got to be kidding me. And they'll say, no, it's Dwayne Wade, it's the Flash. Well, so long as they have that belief, they will not believe that Michael Jordan is the best basketball player. So somehow we're going to have to dislodge that belief that Dwayne Wade is the best. Well, the same is true when we have a God conversation with another person. I think we argue that there's four different defeater beliefs that our neighbors, friends, fellow students have. One of them is a belief that God really is asleep at the wheel today with the world. And to be honest, you can understand why people believe that. I mean, if you just take a look at what's happened in our country in the last 15 years, you've had Virginia Tech shooting, which is the greatest, most tragic shooting on an American college campus. You have 9/11, greatest act of terrorism against the United States. You have Hurricane Katrina, one of the greatest natural disasters to ever hit the United States. And then throw in Columbine, two wars with Iraq. And honestly, people step back and they say, okay, so let me get this right. God loves me, loves the world, and yet, why in the world doesn't he step in? So I believe that's a defeater belief. It's kind of hard to argue God's good, loving, when so many bad things happen. Second, the idea that all religions really are the same. I mean, they might have small differences, but if you're a person of faith, it does not matter if you're a Buddhist, a Hindu, a Christian, a Muslim. It just doesn't matter. A sincere faith will get you where you want to go. Well, as Christians, we have a hard time with that because we want to argue that Christ is the only way to get to God. Another defeater belief, I think, is this idea of that evolution is just true. It is. And anything else, intelligent design argument, is just pseudoscience, or it's just this backdoor attempt to get religion back into the classrooms. And then I would add just one more, is that as Christians, we want to appeal to the resurrection. We love to do that because we feel like that's the deal breaker. How do you decide among world religions? Well, Christianity is true and we can point to the resurrection. I think a defeater belief many people have is just that the disciples are either just flat out lying, or over time their story changed. It grew into a legend. They weren't trying to be malicious. It just took on huge proportions year after year after year after year, and Jesus went from being a social worker to somehow being God.
How does the book deal with those defeater beliefs? You may have already told me, but I'm asking you again.
Well, in the we tackle what we think is one of the biggest ones today, and that is faith in a post 9/11 world. And all we do in the book is we simply say, what are the seven major questions people tend to ask when they have experienced suffering? And again, this book is 155 pages long. You could write five volumes on the problem of evil. So we are just simply skimming the surface, and we're simply trying to answer questions, but then mostly provide illustrations. That's what the book is. It's filled with illustrations from C.S. Lewis, G.K. Chesterton, American Idol, My Name is Earl, Catch Me If You Can, the movie Crash. I mean, we just go through a bazillion illustrations because, again, that's what's going to be remembered. So when it comes to can God be good if terrorists exist, we want to say, could God stop evil? And the answer is he could. And let's say, we call this the deadline illustration. Let's say that God shows up and says, okay, here's what I'm going to do. A week from now, at midnight, I'm going to stop all evil. Now, how would he do that? Well, if you watch YouTube, you've seen the very famous Don't Tase Me, Bro, right? The guy getting tased at a John Kerry rally. Well, let's say that a week from now, God decides I'm going to use a taser gun. And every time somebody does something wrong, I will taser them. So, you know, if somebody steals something, they're hit with a half-second shock. If somebody's going to rape somebody, they're hit with a full second or two. The makers of taser weapons say, you hit a person with 3 seconds of a taser, you're going to stop them. 95% accuracy. So God says, okay, a week from now, I'm going to taser every single person who does everything wrong. But let's add to that, I will also taser you when you have bad thoughts, because bad thoughts often lead to bad actions. And in God's economy, it's a sin to have a chance to do good but not to do it. So a week from now, you're going to get tased if you do something bad, if you have bad thoughts and you fail to do what's good. So would God stop evil a week from now? The answer is unequivocally yes. But he would have a bunch of cowering, beaten dogs in front of him. People who write on parenting talk about you have to address a child's heart. You can't just address a child's actions. And what God would get is a world of people that are obedient in their actions, because they don't want to get hit with an electric shock, a taser gun. But in their heart, they would be just as rebellious towards him. And God has said, I want to change people's hearts, and I will not force them to have the kind of world I want to have, which would be a world free of evil and suffering. As Christians, I don't think there's anything or way to get around that we've got to at least become students of other religions. I just think today we can't put our head in the sand any longer. I mean, 1 out of 5 people in the world are Muslim. Buddhism is the fourth fastest growing religion in the United States. And as Christians, we just can't say, oh, I don't know anything about Buddhism. I don't know anything about Islam. So we just have to become quick students of other religions. And in the book, we do a very cursory handling of Islam and Buddhism. Because we want to ask a person, let's pretend that Buddhism is true. What would life look like if the teachings of the Buddha were really true? And actually, we wouldn't have to imagine very much, because there's a very popular TV show, My Name is Earl, that is really Buddhism 101. If you don't know the premise, My Name is Earl is about a man named Earl who's really a social screw-up, but he wins a very small lottery, and right after he wins it, he gets hit by a car. So now he's in the hospital, and in the hospital, he just reflects upon his life that he's just made one bad decision after another. He has no good luck, and he has what the show calls a karmic moment, which means he realizes, my whole life, I've racked up bad karma. I mean, I've done stupid thing after stupid thing after stupid thing. So I'm going to go back in my life and address every single bad thing I've ever done. He actually makes a list of 300 things, and that is actually the premise of the show. They're simply working through his list. One of them is, I never sent my mother a Mother's Day card. One is, I shot Glenn Waters with a BB gun in the 6th grade. Things like that. So now, but he is systematically working through all of those bad things to rack up good karma to counteract bad karma. And I like to say to a person, what if My Name is Earl was true? And you had to go back and every single bad thing you have ever done in your life is now a list. How long would that list be? I mean, we'd be, 20,000 things. I have no idea. But you have to go back now and address every single bad thing you have ever done in your life. And in the book, we share a quote from Bono, where Bono talks about why he chose Christianity over Buddhism. And Bono said, I need grace. I need grace to break the karma cycle. Because I'm a rock star, he says. Man, I know how big my list would be of bad things. So I need grace that will save me from bad karma. And I think that is true of all of us.
Kind of give me your rundown on the ethics thing. I know you don't want to give away that whole fourth of the book. Sure. But what would be good to just share on how the book addresses the ethics matter? And you can kind of set up the ethics problem.
Yeah, the problem of ethics today is huge. Because most people have a defeater belief. And the defeater belief is, listen, you do your thing, I do my thing. Okay? It's not like there's a right way to do everything. You just kind of got to figure it out. I remember walking across campus one day, and there was a banner. And the banner said, it isn't wrong to think you're right. But it isn't right to think other people are wrong. And man, that is postmodernism to the hilt. So what we want to do is, as Christians, we want to argue for an absolute. A moral absolute simply means that a belief is true for everybody. It doesn't matter where you grew up geographically. It doesn't matter when you lived. If rape is wrong and it's a moral absolute, then rape is wrong. It doesn't matter when you lived or where you live. It's a moral absolute. It applies to everybody. Now, that is precisely what most people will not grant you, is that there's one thing that's right and wrong for everybody. So what we want to do is actually show people, well, you actually already believe in a ton of things that you think are wrong for everybody. And we call this the not to be tolerated list. And we all have this. So I sit down with the person and I just simply present things to them to see what their reaction would be, whether they would make this person's not to be tolerated list. For example, there's a website called Ku Klux Klan for Kids. It's a racist website that teaches elementary kids through interactive games to be racist. Now, when you present that to most common sense people that you're going to come across on campus or where you work, they're going to say, that's sick. That's sick. It's just, that's wrong. And it's like, you know what? I agree. Let's put that on your list. Here's another one. They're called Serbian rape factories, where Serbs raped Muslim women. And a story was done in the Washington Post about this. Sickening, absolutely deplorable. And most people would look at a rape factory, where you're raping women, as that's just wrong. Another one we present to people is a woman who had two kids. The boyfriend she was dating at the time didn't like kids. So she took her two kids, strapped them in the back seat of a car, and drove the car into a lake and drowned the two kids. Now, we would look at that and say, that's wrong. And you could say, well, yeah, but her reason for I don't care what her reason for doing it. There is no good reason to rape people, to have a racist website, and to take two kids and drown them because you want to be single. Well, that is what we call the not-to-be-tolerated list. Now, the million-dollar question once that list is created, and again, classic ones would be torturing babies are wrong, you know, things like that. Once you have your list, I would say to a person, I really agree with your list. And I believe that's wrong as well. But what is your list rooted in? What allows you to say that that list is wrong for every single person? Very interesting conversation to have. It's either going to be rooted in culture. Your culture says this is wrong. It's either going to be rooted in the powerful get to decide what's right or wrong. Or it's going to be rooted in God. And you really only have three options. Well, if it's rooted in culture, then what happens when two cultures just flat out disagree with each other? In the book, we use Nazi Germany, the Holocaust. I mean, we believe that the Nazis were wrong, and they would say to us, well, who cares what you think? As a culture, we believed it was okay. Well, we don't care about that. We believe that's wrong. If you believe that the powerful get to decide what's right and wrong, well, then Adolf Hitler decided what was right and wrong. And for him, it was morally okay to murder 6 million Jews. If you do not root that list in God, then I would argue you cannot believe in a moral absolute unless God exists. Now, and maybe a person will say, okay, God exists, but who's to say it's the Christian God? Well, that's another great question that would probably be a whole nother separate conversation. Huge defeater belief today. I've heard Oprah do this. My boys love to listen to ESPN radio. I've heard Colin Cowherd do this. And that is basically the idea that all religions are heading up a mountain and God's at the top of the mountain. And it does not matter what your path is, right? One path is Buddhism, one path is Christianity, one path is whatever, African religions. Don't fall in love with your path. It's one path, okay? Well, as Christians, obviously, we want to argue that there is one path to God, and that is the person of Jesus Christ, okay? Now, we are not suggesting that you devote the next 10 years of your life and become an expert on every world religion. And in the God conversation, we simply tackle Islam and Buddhism and offer some illustrations from the life of Gandhi and from the life of the Buddha, because I think we have to intelligently talk about these towering historical figures. I mean, Gandhi lived a remarkable life. His compassion for the outcasts was amazing. How he treated people with leprosy and the poor, I think Christ would admire that. And we have to be able to talk intelligently about other religions. So in the book, we just simply introduce readers to the life of Gandhi and to the life of the Buddha. And then we just say, but there are aspects of their teachings that cause us pause and cause us concern. So those, I think we need to have a couple illustrations in our pocket of the good things the Buddha did and the good things that Gandhi did. Or otherwise, it's just like we're blind to the good actions of everybody else, and we just think Jesus is the only world religious leader who's done any good in human history. And that's just not true.
When you're coming to the end of a conversation like that, how do you transition from honoring that religion to turning the corner and saying, but there is only one way to heaven?
Well, and again, we envision in this book, these are multiple conversations. I mean, the God conversation is not one conversation. It's going to be conversations that are going to take place over weeks, months, years, even. What I like to say about world religions is, as I'm on my own faith journey, and I'm trying to figure things out, it is very dizzying to look at all the different religions. But there's one thing I know about all the religions, is that they all can't be true. I know that because just lay out some of their claims and you just see that they contradict each other. For example, let's ask the question, if we're all on a mountain path going up a mountain towards God, who's at the top of the mountain waiting for us? Now, that's very interesting to ask Buddhism that question, to ask Christianity that question, to ask Islam that question. Buddhists would say no one's at the top. There is no God, per se. We share an illustration in the book about an ethics agreement that was put together in North Carolina. And in the ethics agreement with God, they couldn't use the name God because the Buddhist contributors do not believe in God. Muhammad would say, who's at the top of the mountain? Allah, and only Allah. It is blasphemy to say it's Allah and Jesus. No, it's just Allah. Christians would say it's Jesus. So there's no disagreement. And I would just argue that we can't say that all of these are true, right? If I say to you, my mother is dead, and you say to me, oh, that's so sad, and I say to you, well, don't worry, I'm going to have lunch with her tomorrow. You'd be like, okay, I'm sorry, but is she dead or alive? And I say, well, both. You'd be like, okay. I mean, it just makes sense to us that certain claims cannot be true at the same time in the same way. That is really good to point out to a person when it comes to religion. And that's why it's helpful to know just a little bit about Buddhism and Islam to be able to point out the drastic different ways that they answer questions.
All right, I've blown my time budget with you because I know you got to get ready for your trip. But can I ask you for a favorite thing on maybe intelligent design or... anything like that, just a favorite, you know, short one or two liner, three liner paragraph type thing on why that makes sense.
Yeah, when it comes to intelligent design, it's the favorite argument that people tend to use in apologetics because it just makes sense to us in our gut. When we're talking about intelligent design, we're really talking about the argument from design. And but what do we mean by design? I mean, that's very important to define. And for me, I took my kids to Mount Rushmore a couple years ago, and they were bored to tears until they actually turned the path and there was Mount Rushmore, and they saw the faces. And it's stunning to see. And if you were to say to my kids, boy, guys, isn't it amazing how that just happened by chance? Isn't it amazing that wind and rock slides, and over time, that sort of kind of look like a nose, and sort of kind of look... I mean, they're looking at me going, Dad, that did not happen by chance. Somebody carved that. And I'm like, you know what, you're right. It took intention, it took planning, and it took design. And if something shows intention, planning, and design, we want to say, what do we know about design? Right? Does a Mount Rushmore just happen? No. Does a computer just happen? The answer is no. So when we look at the complexity of a human body, my goodness, we want to say that that shows all the signs of design. And we use some illustrations from William Paley, his famous watch illustration. If you're walking on a path and you come across a watch and you open the watch up and you see all the gears and how they work in harmony and they have a purpose, and that is to count out seconds, minutes, hours, you'd stop and you would say, okay, did this watch just happen? Or is there intention, planning, and forethought? And if something exhibits that, then we want to argue that there has to be a planner behind it. And in the book, we really tackle two things, the human body, the absolute complexity of the body. We share some facts about the body that would just blow your mind. And then we step back and we take a look at planet Earth. And there are remarkable things about planet Earth. It makes sense to us. If a computer needs a designer, if a NASA rocket needs a designer, if Mount Rushmore needs a designer, my goodness, look at the human body and planet Earth, and it just begs to say there's a designer behind this.
That's Tim Muehlhoff, co-author of a great book titled The God Conversation. Overflow highly recommends the book, The God Conversation, by J.P. Moreland and Tim Muehlhoff, published by IVP Books. I'm Joseph Hanford. You can find us on the web at overflowshow.com. That's overflowshow.com. Now go pour into someone's life.